Hopefully we don't lose power because you have storms, David, is that correct?
Yeah, it was right before we hit record, there was big thunder. And right after we hit record, the rain stopped and it might be over with. But poor little Duke, he's one of our wiener dogs. One dog just does not care about storms and the other dog just freaks out, walks on our heads all night because he doesn't know what to do with himself. And we try to hold him and cuddle him and he just doesn't know what to do. He just walks. I got no sleep last night.
Bummer. Did you guys have a tornado in your vicinity?
I haven't checked the news, but they were warning us.
It was in Michigan, I think it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was one in Michigan last week.
Yeah, we're under a tornado watch right now, but it's not even raining. It's just a little windy. And I think all of that weather that you have right now is north of us. It's just kind of moving past us. Later tonight, though, we are going to Nashville. And so I know you guys aren't soccer fans, but Messi, in my opinion, is one of the best soccer players in the history of the world.
I think I heard of him.
And so he's he plays for a team out of Miami, and they are coming to Nashville to play. And so I kind of surprised the family we're a soccer family, most of us. And so I surprised them with tickets to go see this game just because it's one of those things, like it's a chance. It'd be like a chance to go see Michael Jordan play. Like you would take that chance, right? Cause you may not get that chance again.
And he's on baseball, right? Michael Jordan?
Yeah. A little bit. That's somewhat true.
Actually, he did. Yeah. Oh, so we're going to go to Nashville and watch Messi play tonight. And the rain in Nashville is going to start at kickoff time.
Oh, no.
It's like solid rain until midnight. So
is it an open stadium? Out.
Do what?
Is it an open stadium?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So it'll be great. Yeah. And our seats are pretty decent seats and they're down in the part that's not covered. So.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Yeah.
It'll be fun. Thanks,
Dad. That to look forward to. Yeah. No.
But, that's cool.
So. Anyway, I'm excited about doing that, but the rain is kind of like, that's going to.
How far is Nashville for a drive for you guys?
Yeah, it's 2 hours.
Oh, yeah, that's close.
Yeah, it's not bad. Definitely worth it for something like that. We've actually gone down to Nashville to see these same two teams. The Nashville FC is like the Nashville pro team. And a couple of years ago, we were on our way to Florida, and we decided this Miami team was coming up to play Nashville. In the same fixture and the same place and everything. And so we drove from here to watch the game and then stayed the night and then went on to Florida the next day because we thought Messi was going to be playing with him. Well, it turns out he was injured or something. And so we got these tickets, went to the... Have I told you guys about that game? It was a disaster. Okay.
I remember this. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll give you the quick version in case you don't. So it turned out he didn't play. And so... You know, we were all disappointed that we were going to go see, thought it was our chance, and then he wasn't there. And we're not huge fans of any particular team as a family, but so Jenny uncharacteristically ordered us all Miami shirts, like, you know, to wear on this thing, because it was like a fun family thing we were doing together a few years ago. So we get these Miami shirts, we go to this, we leave here, we drive down to Nashville. We get there as the national anthem is being played. It took us forever to get parking. We get there. We're like just in time. So we go in, check in, get our tickets. We go to where we're sitting behind one of the goals. I just got like the cheapest seats I could get. And so we go to this place to walk down to our seats. And there's a person standing at the top of the area like that works there. And he was like, oh, you can't sit down here. And I said, well, our tickets are for those seats right there. And he was like, yeah, but you're wearing Miami shirts and that is the Nashville supporter section. And so you can't wear the other team's stuff down there because people fight.
You had to buy like sex t-shirts or something.
Yes, we had to go to the stupid store and buy $40 t-shirts for the entire family for a team that we don't support just so we could go sit in cheap seats. That turns out weren't even seats. We had to stand there and lean up against a bar. Yeah, it was a disaster. It was still fun, but it was a very, very frustrating night. Anyway, so tonight I got us intentionally better seats with chairs, but we're going to get rained on. So, you know, that's fine.
Did I tell you, I must have told you my soccer story when I was in Madrid in like 98, 99. I went to Real Madrid. So I went, I sold a product to the company. It never made it to the market, but I sold the product to Chupa Chups, and they're in Madrid. And it was a little man. It's a little, if you Google my name in patents, you'll see the little lollipop man. And the lollipop, the Chupa Chupa's his head, and you, it's a lollipop stand. So you could put your Chupa Chup down and it stays standing. So I sold it to them, but they never made it. It never made it to the market. But when I went there, they brought me to a Real Madrid game in a box. I mean, this very wealthy family that owns Chupa Chup, and everybody's speaking Spanish. And everyone was like, who's the American? Like, I was like, oh, he's a toy inventor, weirdo friend from New York. And, but
you should put that on a business card. That right there. That's you.
Toy inventor, weirdo friend from New York. Yeah. And in the giant stadium, it was like looking at a movie theater. It was like a tremendous stadium. And there's one section of the pie. It was like on a curve. So it was to the right. We were on the long side of the stadium. And there's this one section of the pie that is, when you look at the stadium, there's like a texture because it was so crowded. It was a very big game. I think they were playing England. There was like a haze of like activity. And then when you look at this one section of the pie, it was like crazy haze. It was like, there was like a fuzz over it of like people moving flags, banners, and, but it was just all jammed into this one section. And I said to my host, I was like, what is that all about? He goes, oh, those are all the people that have Real Madrid memberships, but keep getting in trouble. So they put them all in one spot. So those are the people that act out, throw things on the field, get into fist fights. He goes, they keep them all in one section. And if you get a demerit on your Real Madrid membership, they put you there. And so they were all delinquents, but the physical activity of that one section from, yeah, I must have been a couple hundred yards away up in the box was just, it was so fun just to watch the, and then we got into the game a little late, so we didn't see the entrance, but leaving after the game and all the hooligans, all the Madrid hooligans were outside. It was insane. I had never seen anything like it at that point. It was very, very fun to experience that.
We've been to a few MLS games. MLS is the American Major League Soccer. You know, it's kind of one of the pro leagues. There's a few. And there's an excitement to those games, and people have flags, and there's, you know, people with drums and stuff, and it's fun and loud. But we also went to Nashville one time for a Club World Cup game. So they took clubs from all over the world and came, and, you know, there was a tournament where they played each other. So we got to see a team from New Zealand, I think, and they were playing a team from Argentina called Boca Juniors. And that was bananas. And we sat right in the middle of a bunch of Boca Juniors people. And I didn't know either one of the teams. It was just an opportunity to go see a fun game and everything. And one of our friends who's from Argentina, when I told him who was playing, he was like, yes, you have to go to that game. I'm like, all right, cool. So we took our youngest out of school that day and we went down and we saw this game. And it was bananas. Just, I mean, a whole different level of excitement about every little thing, and, you know, yelling and arguing with the refs at every little thing. And it's a very, very different culture in places, you know, probably like Madrid. It's just a different level of care, but it was a lot of fun.
Anyway. I don't have any soccer stories, but I've been to two different sporting events that were somewhat historic. My dad and I went to a Cleveland Indians Oakland A's baseball game in the 80s. And at this game, Ricky Henderson set a record for the most leadoff home runs, I believe for a career or a year. I can't remember. And then I remember the next year, Topps had a baseball card just for that event. And I was like, I was at that game.
Oh, cool.
Also at that game, this was when the Oakland A's were very popular. And we were trying to get autographs as the players were getting out of the taxis, walking into the stadium. And Jose Canseco would not sign any autographs. He's like, I'm not signing no effing autographs, and just walked right past all the people. So he was kind of
cool.
A jerk.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. Another time in the 80s, we went to a Cleveland Browns Detroit Lions football game in Detroit on Thanksgiving. And in that game, Barry Sanders, in his rookie year, went over 1,000 yards. And then the next year, some company, Topps or Score or somebody, had a football card saying, you know, rookie 1,000 yard rushing dude. And it was just kind of cool that there were these sports cards for two events that I was at.
Did you have either of those cards?
I had the Barry Sanders card. I 100% had the Topps. I was a Topps guy at this time, in my life. And I believe that would have been 87, 88, somewhere around there. And I would collect them all until I would get the whole set.
So, wow. Yeah.
I almost sold Topps a product many years ago. They make some candy products. So it was around the same time when Chupa Chups were inventing various candy products. Didn't work out. But I got to know Topps, and they were in Manhattan. I got to go there a lot. But it was something else I was going to say.
How many products do you think you've sold in that manner? Not the stuff that you make now for you, for your brand, but how many things do you think you've sold to other companies over the years?
I have about 18 or 20 patents that are all expired. So if you Google my name, James DiResta, inside the patent, Google patents, about 18 or 20 patents show up. We probably sold over about 15 years. We probably sold about 50, 60 different products. And of those 50, 60 different products, like six of them made money. The rest of them just fizzled. But seriously, so you'd ask, how would I make money in general? A lot of times, because we develop products, we understood the manufacturing. We went to China, my brother and I. I would sell a product to a company and then product manage it. So I'd sell the product and then I knew I would make royalties on it if it sold. But in the meantime, they're paying me to develop it. And so that's why I had a little bit of a unfair advantage when I would sell a product. I'd make money on it. Most of the time, guys would come up with these like cardboard prototypes, and the concept was sold, and then somebody internally would take it and then they would do it. But because we could do our own products and other people's products, because we'd go to China, I'd go to the factory, I'd go and I understood a lot of the processes. So I would make money developing the product that would never sell. So I would just, I would sell a product and then basically become the employee of the company.
Did you say at one time as a kid, I had this ball, and it was like a grotesque face on the inside, and it was all squishy, and there was like liquid between the ball and the outer vinyl like shell. Did you say you made that? Do you have any idea what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I remember talking about that.
Let
me grab it. Sorry to show you my. So this is my product that made me the most money. It's called Gurgling Guts, and it's a squishy ball inside of a skin. And there's liquid between the skin and the ball itself.
Yeah, yeah.
This is Gurgling Guts. This is the actual product. But we ended up licensing this product, this patent, to Goosebumps. So we made more money selling with the Goosebumps licensing. All the Goosebumps characters were in this ball. So we made more money with that there. And then we came up with a product It was a retainer ball, basically like a PVC ball you'd like let a dog chew on. And then inside of it, we put the ballistic gel. So when you squeezed it, the ballistic gel would pop out of the zits. And then around the same time, China knocked that off. And there was a very famous MTV commercial, maybe you guys might remember it, where it was a pig and it was just like up close on it. It was like a meme. Now it would be like a 2-second meme. It was a pig, and this guy on the camera would squeeze the pig and the gel would come out of its butt. And then it was like an MTV teaser. And at the time, everybody knew it. It was like, I'm like, you know that MTV thing where like they squeeze the pig and the gel comes out of its butt? They're like, yeah. I'm like, I own that patent, but I don't make any money on it because it was knocked off 1600 ways to Sunday.
Oh, wow.
So that was my patent, but I never made any money on it. But that was even more cool to say, like, yeah, they stole my thing and put it on MTV.
Yeah.
Like, than the money.
I mean, those little MTV bumpers and teasers, they were amazing back in the day.
They were really
fun. You can find some compilations of them.
Yeah, the animations of the MTV logo itself was always so cool.
Yeah, so good.
But yeah, the toy business was very volatile, but that's how we positioned to be able to maintain a career, is that we would always project manage the things we sold. In many cases, not all, but in many cases, we project managed the products that we sold. And that's how I was able to basically garnish a living while those salaries help make up for all the dead time between the wins, you know.
Now, when you were designing those things, did you just have the idea and then pass the idea on to teams, or were you trying to make some of these yourself to come up with prototypes?
Oh, yeah, a little of everything. And then at one point we ended up, when you sell something to Mattel or Hasbro, for instance, which I only placed a couple of items there and they never really made it to market, you just give it off and they never even, the next time you hear from them is if there's a royalty check. They don't care about your input at all, but because they have huge teams that take it and then they have big branding teams that are like, this is a good item. Let's put this in the G.I. Joe line. So some stupid mechanism that would be an interesting dollar aisle thing for me would end up as like a gimmick inside somebody else's, some other brand. It's like, you know, could be like this Kung Fu grip, for instance, could have been like a novelty item, but then it ends up as Kung Fu grip on G.I. Joe. That predates my life. I was in like in the 70s. I didn't invent that. I'm just using that as an example. So with the bigger companies, they would find a little nugget inside your invention and place it inside some other brand. Whereas the smaller companies, which is where we ended up working with more often because they were easy to deal with, and I could sell myself as a project manager and me and my brother could garnish a living from them because they were so small. They'd be like, we love you. This is the perfect example is Gurgling Guts. I thought of the idea when we sold it to these guys. They were very seasoned toy guys. They knew everything about the toy business, but it was just two brothers. And they were like, look, if you could help us develop it with your experience. And we went and helped them to develop it. I visited the factory and we got the product off the ground with their help and our help. Like they leaned on us a lot to help with the engineering and the packaging. If you look here, we came up with this crazy character, Dr. I Am Gory, Gurgling Guts. This is all in that character. This was in that gross section of the 90s when all these gross toys came out. We just happened to be right in line. I mean, we weren't, like, it was just sort of like everything bubbled up and everybody had something gross. It just all came together. But this whole concept was born out of the squishy ball. And I would just sit and play with toys all day long and just come up with ideas and kind of not too different than what I do now. But now I'm really inventing things that I need so I could exploit processes that I either want to learn or I want to show off, whether it's the CNC because I'm working for a CNC company or whether it's this or whether it's that, or now I'm playing with pottery. That's what I did all week. I'm making these pottery tiles and doing a little bit of, so my video this weekend is going to be me experimenting with tiles and incorporating the CNC mold making process with clay, with tiles. And then the tiles ultimately will be used at the graveyard house. And I thought of that like kind of while we were on podcast together a couple weeks ago. And so that'll be my video coming out this weekend. I have stuff in the kiln right now. I should be able to be cool enough to touch when we're done. I started it yesterday morning. So I got a whole bunch of stuff in the kiln. This is really exciting. When I got the kiln about in 2021, just before we started the show, the kiln showed up. I really was intimidated. I didn't really know what to do with it. I didn't understand it. I didn't understand the recipes. I didn't understand what clay, how to fire it, any of that. But that's all becoming much more clearer to me now with the instruction I'm learning through David, my pottery guru, and just experimenting and seeing videos and not understanding what they were talking about. Now it's clear to me. So I'm watching lots and lots and lots of videos on pottery in general and trying to find my voice in there, trying to find what unique thing I can bring to it. You see so many incredibly talented potters out there and they're all being fed to me on Instagram. And I'm looking at all that and I take it all in and I think to myself, what's going to be my unique contribution to this art? And whether it's just doesn't leave my property or goes out into the world, what is it that I can bring to it? What with all my knowledge and all my experience, how can I funnel that through this new craft and bring out something new and interesting? Not just different to being different, but different because it's an amalgamation of everything I know.
Right.
I try to approach projects like that where like, okay, I'm getting into acrylic painting or whatever, but I'm also a woodworker. How can I combine those two that I'm doing something that nobody else does, and maybe somebody else is already doing that, but I don't want to see that. I'm remixing two things to try to make it into something new.
It's funny to me when like I go into certain, you ever visit somebody's studio and they only do, say, for instance, leather work, and everything in the shop is in need of repair, or they decide to use, say, for instance, like a cardboard cutting mat just because they don't treat themselves well. I'm like, just go get a self-healing cutting mat. They're like, oh, I don't know, this works fine. I'm like, you don't understand how much easier life would be if you had like a regular cutting mat. Oh, I don't know, this is fine. So when you see people that limit themselves like that with processes, and maybe I'm just overly curious, and then I, honestly, because of my YouTube career, I've gotten 50 times more curious than I probably would be if I wasn't trying to exploit processes and demonstrations and stuff as I've been for the last so many years. But there's a couple studios I visited recently, and I'm just like, you know, you can go to Home Depot and buy a piece of wood that would, you can get like a quarter sheet of plywood. You don't have to buy a whole sheet of plywood, and you could like put it on this tabletop and it would give you a little bit more advantage, make your workflow easier. You don't have to deal with like three books under the corner of your table. You could just go buy another piece of 2x4 and make yourself a proper table.
Sometimes you just don't know. You're just in your own little world, and you don't know anything that exists outside of that.
It's really crazy. Like, you know,
it's funny because we all do that. We just do it in different ways than we see other people do it. You know, we don't recognize those things in ourselves as easily, for sure.
No. So, well, Jimmy, it kind of touches on the topic I started talking about before we got on camera, which was my situation with this tow truck. I don't know if we haven't really opened the show traditionally today. We're just kind of zipping into it. But the idea of sometimes people just don't treat themselves well, like you don't set yourself up for success in this. So I dug into the back of the tow truck. This is the story. And I realized the mechanics on the back of the wheel lift and all that hydraulic mechanical stuff in the back, I knew it was a mess. I didn't know how bad of a mess it was. And so the other day, finally, I've owned the thing for 6-8 months. I finally cut the ratchet strap that it came with that held all those guts up inside the truck and let them fall down to the cement floor gently. They came out because it's like a all greasy mess. It's moved slowly and it settled down to the floor. And I looked at it, and some mechanic somewhere along the way, I guess everything froze from being sitting and not using. All the mechanical joints froze collectively. So there's three joints. If all three joints are frozen, then the hydraulics aren't going to allow this thing to move. And somebody went in there with a Sawzall and cut three pins on two sides. So now instead of having three pivot pins, I have 9 pieces of cut pivot pins. In the hydraulic ram, there's a piece on both sides. And then in the framework of this mechanical wheel lift, there's a plug on each side. And they got to that point and was just and then probably were like, okay, I got all these parts free, but now I don't know what to do. I don't know how I'm going to get this 1-inch pivot shaft out of, now instead of one pivot shaft that's 15 inches long, you got three pieces of it and stuck completely inside all the mechanics. And I think somebody just said, you know what, this is beyond my scope, I don't care anymore. And then just ratchet strapped it up, and then the truck ended up with me through Facebook Market. And the guy I bought it from definitely wasn't the one who did this, because he didn't really know much about it. So I can't blame the guy I bought it from. He got it as a wreck, and then now I got it as a wreck from him. But with some tenacity and some brute force, I was able to get, so that there was actually really 7 pins stuck in, 2 had fallen out right away. And I only have 3 more to get out. The 3 most complicated ones I have to get out. And they might pop out gently if I just give it a little bit of brute force, but they're just in a weird spot. So by the end of the day, I might have them all out. But it just leads me to believe of like, some people are just in their bubble, and they're like, he must have just cut them and said, meh, that's enough. I don't know what else to do, and just gave up on it. So I don't know if what I was saying before relates to that in any way, but I guess it's just a certain laziness that people have, and they get to a point.
Well, I mean,
just like,
so I don't know if it's laziness, but like it's a trade-off, right? So
you have
this one, you get to that point and you look at it and you go, well, one path is I continue down this thing and try to learn how to fix this thing. And I spend all this time and money and whatever trying to get this to work, or I could put that same time and effort and money into something that I know will be productive for me or whatever, you know. So you're cutting your losses or you're not. And it's maybe not as simple as like being lazy, you know.
You're right.
It's how
you're
I
right.
approach
I
woodworking
said.
Jigs. Like you can make every single jig that you want. But do I want to spend my time making a jig, or do I want to spend my time making cool stuff? And sometimes I do make the jig because I'm in that process right now because it's fun. But other times I just, I'll pay the money so I can make the thing that I want to make. It's just where you want to spend your energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's true. I mean, it seems like the person who got to this point on this project of the sold tow truck just said, it's not worth it going forward anymore. And they just ratchet strapped it up so they could push it around the yard. And now it's in my backyard.
And I mean, I feel that tension, like with the Ghia. Over and over and over, I do a little work on it. And then I look at it, I'm like, is this worth it? Like, am I really going to finish this? Is it worth continuing on? Or am I just dumping more time into something that I'm never actually going to be able to complete?
I had that overwhelming feeling the other day when I was able to diagnose what was really wrong with the mechanics of this truck. I looked at it and I said, this is over my head. I don't know how I'm going to get this out. But then I started to focus on each individual piece. I was like, okay, let me see if I can just get this one out. And if I can get that out, that'll give me clues to the next one, and so on and so on.
Bob, is completion important, or is it the journey?
Well, I think both. It depends on the day. Depends on the project. I think with the Ghia, I think it's important, because otherwise it is. Okay. So if I start a piece of furniture and I don't finish it, you can burn it and get it out of the way. If I take a car and I break it into two parts and I fill up a garage with parts and I buy all the stuff and then I don't finish it because I die or because whatever, my kids and my wife have to go to this building worth of parts and go, now what? What do we do with this?
Facebook
so
market,
for me,
best offer.
Yeah, I guess. But for me, in that particular project, yes, completion is the point. Because I think the joy in that car, or in any car for me, would be being able to drive it and enjoy it. The work is interesting and new, but it's also repetitive and tedious and not... Like, it's fun the first time. And then after that, it's like, yeah, okay, I got to weld another panel on. Got it. Yeah. You know, but it's different, I think, for each person, each project. You know, I think, you know, we talk about a lot of times how we enjoy the process of learning something, of doing something, and then you get to close to the end and you're kind of done with it because, like, you don't care so much about the output. And that is true for sure. But, the Ghia, at least, is not that. I think the output will be the enjoyable part for me, or the most enjoyable part. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for the longest time, my favorite part of any project was the beginning and the end. I love designing things, and then I love looking at the thing that I made. And then slowly over the years, I've enjoyed the process a lot more of trying to learn new things. And so many times, right before the end, I'm like, I just want this to be over with because I'm ready to move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
It's why I don't care if projects go into the fire pit, because I'm over it. I have no attachment to it anymore. I just want to do the next thing.
Yeah. I want to jump back real quick because, Jimmy, you were talking about way back, you were talking about pottery. Mm-hmm. And I know that you went to school for design. Mm-hmm. So I know you've been taught by people design wise. I know that you've learned a lot of skills from other people, but I don't know that I've ever heard you take a class before from someone who is exceptional at a thing, who has like a long history of that. And maybe you have. So the question is, is taking a class and being taught by somebody with a lot of experience on a single thing, is that something relatively new for you, or is that something you've only done a few times?
No,
you're somebody who can just pick up stuff here and there. So,
well, I when I was a teacher at the School of Visual Arts, we could take courses. We could take courses for free. So I always took advantage of that. So while I was I graduated college in 90. So I graduated art school in 90. And then I started teaching in 92. And then for the next 10 or 15 years, I always took classes. It was almost a thing where I would take evening classes back at the school because I'd go back up to Midtown. I was on 2nd Street. School was on 23rd Street. So the campus was on 23rd. There was a few buildings in that vicinity. So I would always take a computer class. That's when I first started learning about Maya. I took Maya courses in the new computer department in the late 90s. And I would always go back to school. I would always take one, sometimes two classes a semester, whether it was programming or whatever, just to get I wouldn't always continue in those things, but I would get a smattering of learning. I remember I took a web design class, and I sat through the whole class, and I would always be the teacher's pet because they all would find out that I was also a teacher at school. And a lot of these evening courses were also taught by the same teachers that taught day courses. So they just did it to get some extra money. And, I was always the teacher's pet then, for instance, I remember taking a programming class or like a web design class. We had to like type out and parentheses. And I was just like, this is the opposite of fun. I'm not having fun here. But I stuck it out. I did all, I think usually there were 10 classes in a semester for the evening classes, and I would always do them. And then you're reminding me that occasionally my father would want to go. My dad always wanted to learn photography. He was a photographer, my dad. He was good at photography, but he was one of those people that always needed instruction from a professional, even though he knew it. He just was a little insecure with that. So I remember taking photography classes with my dad a few times, and I would know everything the teacher was talking about. They'd be like, this is your aperture and this is your speed. And I was like, okay, we're like in kindergarten when it comes to this. But I would just sit there and listen. And I would say, even though I know everything the teacher's talking about, there's got to be something I could pick up from this particular artist that I otherwise wouldn't have got if I didn't come to this class. So I would just sit there and I wouldn't be like, I know what you're talking about. I would just sit there and listen. And even though I would always just sit there and be a sponge. And so I did that with my father a few times. We took about 3 photography classes, and we'd have to go back and show the pictures we took that week. And that was fun. It was an excuse to hang out with my dad. That was years ago. That was about 10 years earlier. And then this particular pottery class I'm taking, David's been a potter, him and his wife, Judy, they've been potters for 35, 40 years. They know everything there is to know about clay and pots and kilns and glazes. And so when I'm there with them, I'm just asking dumb questions. I'm just, what is this? How do you do that? And a lot of the time we're spent just talking, and I'm just absorbing information. And when I watch him work, he gives me instruction, but at the same time, there's so many subtleties I'm picking up from these two experienced potters, just being in their environment. So lately, every Friday, I spend a couple hours with them. And I said to them last time, I was like, I'll come next week and then I'll start weaning off. And they laughed. They go, you don't have to wean off. You can come as much as you want. Because sometimes I feel like they're kind of doing their business, and I'm just like, I'll find something to keep me busy. But I really respect people that know more than me about something. And I'm never like, I know what you're doing. I just sit there and watch. I keep my mouth shut. I'm never a know-it-all. It's really important. Timber framing is another one. When the timber frame classes come to East Durham here, every summer there's a timber frame class. I just sit and watch the pros. I just sit and watch and watch and watch and watch. And sometimes I know exactly what they're doing. And I just keep my mouth shut because it's just more important to just absorb it. And like, you know, why do we go back and watch the same YouTube videos over and over again? We know them. Even though I'm watching something I understand, I'm watching it again because there'll be some subtle difference that I otherwise wouldn't have done.
Yeah.
So, well, I really do. I really think it's important. If you think you know everything, you just got to keep your mouth shut and learn from somebody that knows it.
Yeah. And I totally agree with that. And I think the reason I ask that is because we have access to so much quick knowledge, right? And we have access to so much deep knowledge on YouTube if we go to look for it. But given our jobs, we also are constantly trying to produce and like quickly ingest and reproduce some new skill or some new material usage or something like that. And so it's not as often that I think any of us have the opportunity to do what you're doing with pottery, is to like set aside the media part of it and the job part of it and go dive deep on a regular basis on something and actually learn it, not learn it in the smallest amount possible so you can make a video about it, which is what I always do.
That's what I did and the first time. A couple of tchotchkes around the house that I made in a video real quick. And I'm thinking to myself, God, I was like, I shouldn't have done that then. I should have waited. But, you know, I've done it a few times.
But it's dipping your toes into something. But it's hard for me to even figure out how I would justify the time to go take a class on something, to go deep on it, because I don't know why. I started to say because, like, I knew what the answer was there, but I don't. I don't know why that's hard to justify, but it would be hard for me to convince myself that I could set aside the time to go deep on one thing for very long, you know, even though it would be really helpful. A couple of years ago, I actually applied to the local community technical college because they have like automotive, like an automotive course, and they have a machining course, and they have there were a couple other things that were interesting. And I went ahead and got like ready to where I could pick classes and everything. And then I started looking at the class schedule because I was just like, not trying to get another degree, but I was like, you know, I could learn the automotive stuff and I could just go down that path. And then I started looking at what all I would have to invest to get to the stuff that I didn't know. And I was like, like, I can't go to 8 a.m. classes 3 or 4 days a week for the next,
right,
you know, year to be able to get to the bodywork thing. Like, I can't do that. And so
that's when you make friends with the guy down at the local body shop and you just short circuit the path and
yeah,
you go hang out with the guy.
Well, and that was kind of like where I landed.
Sandwiches
like
or whatever.
If I was looking to build a career in that, yes, absolutely. You have to do the prep work to be able to get to the actual work totally. But I was looking at, you know, how do I make the hobby stuff that I'm already doing more efficient? And it's not more efficient in my case to spend a year taking prerequisite courses to be able to then learn how to do the thing for 10 weeks that I want to learn how to do. Which is a shame because, you know, I wish that my pace, my tempo of how I learn things and how I do things, I wish I could allow myself to invest a little bit in some of that prerequisite type stuff so that when I learned something new, it was a deeper learning and not just a bare minimum to make a thing or move ahead or, you know, whatever. But that's just me. Anyway, that's why I asked that. We totally did not talk about what everybody's working on. David, what have you been working on lately?
Well, I think we talked about the slab flattening jig that I started last week. And then I had to put that on pause for a little bit. I had to shoot a couple of ads for shorts and Instagram, and we're getting back to it today. So I got it working. I flattened a slab and it worked, but it was a mess. My dust collection on there was just not working. And so I made some improvements to it. And then we're going to flatten another slab for that's going to be later today. Hopefully the better version of it. And it's a nice jig. It's one of those things like I made this and now it opens up doors to future projects. And, it's just satisfying when you get linear rails that are all perfectly set up and, it's like, just like a big etch-a-sketch and it just flies back and forth and it feels so good. And I think last week we talked about the walnut cookie that I was flattening. And I want to cut out the centerpiece for a future project. So this is kind of like part one of that project. And I want to cut out the centerpiece and put a chrome insert in there. And we were discussing, like, how do I cut something that's 5 inches thick? And I haven't done it yet, but I have a very good plan now. It started on the podcast, and then the idea finalized when I was talking to Brian Prusa, but I don't need to cut out the perfect shape out of this big, it's 4 inches and 3/4. That's how thick it is. And then it's around 40 inches wide by 30 inches tall. And I'm cutting out the center of that. And so I have long drill bits. We're going to drill holes, just inside of what I want to cut out. And then on the underside, I'm going to take a router and I'm just going to connect the dots about an inch deep. And then on the other side, Brian Prusa says, hey, Festool makes a 5-inch, very stiff blade for your jigsaw. And he says you can cut 5 inches with it if you go very slow, because the recommend the recommendation is nothing more than 4 inches. But I've already got it, I'll have it routed out on the bottom side, that path. And so on the top side, we'll cut that out with the jigsaw. That should work. So I ordered the blades. Thank you, Brian. And we'll get to that in a week or so. And then I'm going to kind of rough out the rest of the shape. So it's still going to be organic, but it's going to kind of follow the offset outline of the outside of the cookie. And then I ordered this huge brass plate that I'm going to, it was like $400. So hopefully this experiment works for the sheet of brass, but I'm going to, it's going to go on the backside. It's going to be rabbited out and it's going to go on the backside, and then it's going to kind of bubble out towards the front a little bit. And then there's going to be some dimples in there. And, I got this great book, Creative Metal Forming. So I've been learning how to shape brass. It's like the, you see, I think mostly in copper, it's kind of like the same technique. And so I will start hammering out the bubble that's going to be there. And then I plan on having it chromed, and
nice.
It's going to be a very expensive piece, because that 40 by 30 piece of brass was $400. I think the chroming is going to be another $400.
Chroming is always pricey.
Yeah. There's cheaper options. I did a blacksmithing plant sculpture a few years ago. I took a class at my, 6 week class, speaking of classes, at my local art museum. And I made this like snake plant sculpture, and the chroming was going to be way too much. So we did a mirror powder coat. A local company did that. It's not as mirror like. It's a very dull. It sort of looks chrome, but it's not completely chrome.
Is that polishable? Like, could you polish the powder coat into more, I don't know, mirror like?
I don't know. See, the chroming process is, and I know very little about it, but it's like a multi-step process where you have a back color, and then there's a middle layer, and then
several
there's the several dips. Yeah. And I don't know that the powder coating would do the same thing, but I also don't know what I'm talking about. So
I don't know shit either. So, but, you know.
You but know anyway, yeah. And then there'll be a big metal base for this thing. I hope it comes out cool. Otherwise, it's a very expensive experiment. But in my head, it's super awesome.
Yeah. So I'm assuming that will be part of the art show.
I hope so. The last time I tried to get something chromed, they were like 6 weeks out because they batch things together. So it's going to take me a while to make this thing and then to have that piece chromed. I mean, I've never hammered brass in my life, so I don't even know if that's gonna work out. But I'm hoping the goal is for the art show for sure.
Right. So what type of business are you taking it to get it chromed?
A local plating company. There's if you're getting your bumper re-chromed, you would go to this place.
I see. Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. Years ago, in Savannah, I had an old guitar bridge. That was the chrome had come off of it. It was from the 60s. And I ended up taking it to, there was a motorcycle painting shop type place in Savannah. I can't actually remember what the business was, but I think they did motorcycle painting. Anyway, they could do chrome stuff in-house. And so I ended up taking this thing to them, and you know, it was small. It's not giant like what you're doing, but it was a small thing, and they stripped all the old chrome off of it, got it completely clean, and then re-chromed it, and it just looked brand new. And it wasn't terribly expensive because it was so small and everything. And I have no idea what the process or anything like that, but it was interesting that it was a motorcycle place where they were constantly doing that type of work with small stuff. And
I restored a Cadillac in the early 90s, and I had some of the stuff played. It was always so pricey. I found a place on Long Island that replated stuff, but it's expensive.
Let's see. So for me, I've not really been doing very much since the last time we recorded. I finished up the die video where, and that video is out. this weekend where I made the metal die to fold the piece stuff for the Ghia. And it was so funny because the comments were like, you made this way more complicated than it had to be. Why didn't you just use a break to fold the pieces? And I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, that's not the point. You're missing the point. I was using a simple objective to learn how to do a process, not to make the piece. And I mentioned that in a video, but anyway, there were, the comments were not as positive as usual on this one, but I, they weren't all negative either. But it was just funny because sometimes people will miss the point of the video.
The learning was the point. It wasn't.
Yeah. But whatever. So the next video will be finishing up the outside of the pool house because it's done. The screen is up to cover the pool equipment and the gutters and the downspouts are on and there's a light above the door. And so like that stuff is all done. Thanks. And so I've taken the last few days and it's been a combination of like trying to clean up and trying to catch up. And now that we have a puppy, there's one day a week where like Jenny already has stuff that she's committed to in the mornings, but the puppy can't really be in the crate all day. So my Monday mornings until after lunch are basically just like playing with the puppy. So it takes a huge chunk of the beginning of my week and makes it kind of unproductive, which isn't terrible, but I'm now finding ways to like, okay, well, if I play with the puppy, if we go out in the backyard and I kind of play with him, I can also take a laptop and do some computer work. And so it's, you know, I'm shuffling around my schedule a little bit. But also yesterday, my oldest is headed to college in the fall and he had a job shadowing day because seniors don't have to, take this test that they were doing. So he was home, and then we also went and drove to the college that he is planning to go to last night for an event. But anyway, so during the day, he job shadowed me, and so it was a productive morning. It was only the morning, but it was really productive because I actually got to put tools away while I had him sweep. And we had fun hanging out and stuff and spending time together, but it was like, cool, I need you to sweep every bit of the floor in the shop, in all the little corners and all the nooks and crannies and all the places that I don't ever get to while I put away all these tools from the pool house. And so it felt really productive because I actually had two people doing things in the shop, and it's nice and clean now, stuff. But tomorrow, not tomorrow, yeah, tomorrow, I think I'm going to head back out and start working on the Ghia again. And in the die video, I mentioned that like this back bottom quarter was the last of the metal, like the metal work, the body work to be done, not the body work, the metal work. And in saying that in the video, I was like, oh wow, this is actually kind of close. Like this, it's one little section. It's about like this, you know, and it's the inside and the outside. It's not super easy, but like, I should just go finish that. And a few of the people in the comments, when I said that in the video, like, this is all that's left, and it's hard to make videos about, a few of the comments were like, yeah, but we just want to see you finish it. So make a video about it, you know. So I'm going to go try to figure out an interesting way to make a video about cutting out and rewelding more metal one more time. So I'm going to try to get it done. And I think I'm going to focus a little bit more over the next couple of days on getting the work done in making a video about it rather than making an interesting video and trying to get the work done.
Mm.
Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And which is weird. It feels like I'm kind of going into it with...
Here's the thing. You're going to go and you're going to get the work done. And in the back of your mind, you're going to be thinking, what is the story? And then something in the middle of the project is going to be like, this is the story right here. This is the video. And it's going to be one little thing that you learned or a little hiccup that you come across. And that's going to be the story. So just go get the work done, keeping in mind that you need a story out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a
video.
Point.
By story, I mean video.
Yeah. So, I'm going to go, you know, make that effort this week, and it'd be really cool to be able to step back from that thing and be like, yeah, the metalwork is done, you know? And I say that knowing that in 6 months when I go to do some other step, it's going to be like, oh, look, I have to cut out this whole section and re-weld this section because I did it wrong the first time to make it fit or whatever, you know? So it's probably not truly done, but it is kind of interesting to think about the fact that I could be close on that major piece of it. And if I can get the metalwork done, then it's like probably a couple of days off camera of Bondo, of just like body filler, you know, just going out and doing like around the car and then sand around the car and then do another thing around the car. So the body actually could be getting kind of close, which is crazy. I just need to like keep picking at it until it's actually ready to go. I don't know if I told you all, I spent a little while putting the doors back on it. And I was really worried about that because when I had to, I cut out the rocker panels underneath the doors, right? And completely replaced them. And this is way back, like 25 years ago when I started this car, that was one of the first things I had to do was cut this whole section out. And you're supposed to weld in bars across the door opening to hold that in place. And I did, but I don't think I did it as well as you're supposed to or correctly. And it was on a lift. And so I think the whole body settled a little bit and, you know, it didn't stay exactly where it was supposed to stay. I think, I don't really know. And I wasn't sure how to prove that after the fact. So I put the rocker panels in, measured everything a bunch of times, leveled it, tried to make sure it was right. And then I put the doors back on one time and like they would not close at all, not even close. And then I fiddled around with it a little bit and then was able to get them to kind of close, but they're really tight. Anyway, recently I went back and started looking at that again and trying to figure out what I would have to do about it. And one of them, I was able to just adjust the hinges and it closes. And it's like, oh, cool. Like this door does what it's supposed to do. Now, I don't know that the gap around the door is going to be exactly perfect, which is a thing for car people to really want to get. I don't know that I'm going to be able to pull that off.
But the other door, I'll tell you a trick, but tell me, finish your story. I'll tell you a trick.
Well, the other door sticks. The other door sticks quite a bit. And it sticks both in the back where it closes, like where it's the outswing part, where it touches the, where you would get in. It's rubbing there, but then the front of it has to pass by the fixed body panel, right? Like they have to pass by each other. And that fixed body panel I replaced. And I think when I replaced it without the door on, I didn't get the shape quite right. So those two pieces are like just barely rubbing as they pass by each other. And once it gets closed, it looks fine, but I got to figure that out. And I think that's probably just like hammering, heating and hammering that panel to get it to shape.
You could just try just pushing it in a little bit with a rubber mallet. Just tap it with a rubber mallet. Right. I mean, you might not even notice.
But the hard thing is with the getting both sides of that door to actually be where they're supposed to be, you have to take the door off, do the work, put the door on, see if it works. You know what I mean? So it's just tedious. And that's, I kind of wanted to set aside a day for, I'm going to get the door right. And I haven't done that yet. And the trunk is the same kind of deal. Like it closes, it lines up pretty well. It's not quite right, but I think it's shapeable to where I can get that right. So I think once I get the metalwork done and then get the four panels, the doors in the front and the back to actually like close and pass by each other, that's going to feel like a pretty big step, you know, that all of this stuff will go back on and be where it's supposed to be and open and close. And anyway, what's your tip, Jimmy?
I'm looking for a quick screen grab. What I do is I did it when I restored the truck and, I'll take either a piece of styrene. In the case of the truck, I just use a piece of corrugated board from the garbage and I stick it in the door jamb in the door seam. And then if that's say an eighth of an inch wide, I just put that down the whole door seam. I cut it so it lays inside the whole door seam. And then on the car itself, I smear Bondo to fill in that crack. So I smear Bondo all along the side on the the car side, not the door, because the door, you just have a little tiny rounded edge of metal. You can't really put Bondo on that because it's going to not stay. But on the car, you have a lot more surface area to build up the Bondo. And so I smear it on one side of the cardboard while it's pressing against the bead of the door while the door is closed. Let that cure, gently open the door while it's in the gel state, peel the cardboard out, and then you close the door. Now you have a perfect gap. And then you let the Bondo cure, and then you sand in the Bondo into the door jamb. Now, you know, purists are going to be like, that's blasphemy, but, you know, I'm just trying to make it look good for camera.
Yeah, and I'm past the point of blasphemy on this car. Screw that. So, this is my car, and I just want it to be all right.
So I showed it, and when I restored the old blue flatbed years and years ago, I'm looking for a good still to send you. This might be it. Anyway, so it maintains the gap. Yeah, whatever thickness of material you stick in there, it maintains that gap.
Yeah, hopefully I have enough gap. If I think I'm a little worried more about there being areas that are too close to each other than there being too far
from
each other.
Right. That makes sense to you.
But we'll see when I actually get to that. Anyway, that's kind of where I'm headed with the Ghia. I really do. This is the right season to work on it, and I usually miss this because it's not too hot for, you know, being out there. It's not too cold to do metal work and body filler work, because the winter is, it's almost impossible to do those things. The metal soaks up the heat too quickly because it's so cold, and then the body filler doesn't ever set up because it's too cold, you know. So this is the time. And it's really interesting because this time that I'm also focusing on it, trying to focus on it and motivated to do it, I also have this list of other upcoming things that I want to do and things that I've committed to doing that I want to do. And they're just big, like a lot of effort projects coming up probably through the fall. And so I'm like, well, why am I motivated to do this thing that I have a hard time doing, the Ghia, at the same time as I have all of this commitment and all of this interest in doing these other big time consuming things? It's just kind of weird how it works out. But anyway, got a lot of work ahead of me. And I'm excited about most of it. So that's cool. But anything else going on?
When the snow melts and the weather is warm, it really motivates. It's so motivating.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is.
You know, it's the cold is, you just like, your shoulders like this. And then when it's warm out, you're like, oh, I can let my shoulders down. You know, oh, oh wow. Birds are chirping for real. And I'm like, all the turkeys and the birds walked up to the porch yesterday afternoon for the first time all winter. They're like, hey, what's up? Remember us? I'm like, oh, yeah, you guys need food still. what there's a garden hose in the chat. What was that about? Is that something you wanted to talk about, Dave?
We were, before we hit record, we were talking about you know, the work previous people did.
Ruin
like the problem is, I forgot how you phrase it. The problem is the previous fix that didn't work.
Because we were trying to hash out a concept around the concept of the tow truck. And I said something to the effect of, when you go to repair something that somebody you don't know did, you realize they made the problem worse, and you think the problem is the problem, but it's their repair is the problem.
Yes.
And you just like literally clean away their garbage, and then the repair is very simple.
So this photo of this garden hose, the previous owner like terminated a water line underneath the house that I think used to go to a dishwasher. And this hose with some pipe clamps and some sort of metal end what was used to terminate this water line.
And it still was under pressure the whole time.
Yes. And then after so many years, it gave in and our crawl space flooded.
It's such a convoluted solution. I think that's sort of the wild thing. Like, this seems like extra effort to try to solve something.
Yeah.
And it's bad, man.
And it's so bad. When our crawl space flooded is when I had like peak COVID. I was really sick. And we had to get out of the house for 3 days while they disaster company came and cleaned up, and we had to go run an Airbnb. And
I remember that.
Such an awful moment. But yeah, this fix is so stupid.
It looks like somebody was like, oh, you know what? I got to give me that thing. And then I'll go to the hardware store. And then once the water stops and the emergency is put down, you're like,
then I'll fix it.
Dinner? Oh, let's. And then like you're like a week later, like, I got to get in there and change that little piece of garden hose. And you're like, whatever, it's the summer, nothing's going to freeze, it's fine. And then the winter comes and you're like, let's sell the house. And you're like, oh, I forgot to fix, who cares? It's not my problem anymore.
Yeah, it's not leaking. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
I actually have this photo saved as my favorites in my phone because I have to reference it so much because it was such a stupid fix that I talk about it all the time.
You did get to it really quickly. I was wondering about that because as soon as we mentioned it, you were like, whoop, pull out your phone and like send it.
I thought it came in before we even got together. I didn't realize.
That's funny. Cool. Well, any other thoughts on anything?
I'm going to send you guys some. I'm sending you guys some pictures of the pins that had to get in and out.
Cool. Well, I want to thank our Patreon supporters for supporting us and helping us do this show. We are very grateful for the opportunity to do it and for the support. And huge thank you to our top supporters. They go above and beyond. And they are A Pretty Big Deal, Inc., Albers Woodworks, Chad from Mancrafting, Chris McCormick, Nick Ryan, Odin Leather Goods, Pete Rondo, Rich at Lowen Design, Scott at Dad It Yourself DIY, The New Janky Workshop, and Works by Solo. I think there's an opening in that list. There might be a free spot. Usually we don't have free spots in that list, but I think there is one in case anybody wants it. But big thanks to them for, you know, long-term, over-the-top support. We are really grateful for you all. But everybody gets the after show. Everybody on Patreon at every level gets it. And you can go to patreon.com/makingit, sign up at any level, and you get the after show and links to the video after show if you want to see us. there's a picture of Jimmy and a turkey.
I'm sending you guys a bunch of pictures. This is like,
this isn't that, dude.
Sending you guys a photo
with your bro.
I'm sending you a photo essay of my whole week. Yeah, me and the turkey was just sitting there. It was funny.
Anyway, big thanks to everybody at Patreon. We really appreciate you. You guys have anything to recommend this weekend?
Oh, yeah. This weekend? I'm going to say it before either of you say it. The Simone Getz video of...
The G is non-existent.
Getz.
I mean, it's there, but it's...
Simone Getz?
Yetch.
Simone Yetch.
Say it with a Y.
So her product company is called Yetch Store, and that is the pronunciation for her name, which is spelled Gertz.
Yetch. So it's funny. Someone tagged me yesterday in the Instagram post of her new expanding fruit bowl, and in it, the handle is the ice pick sheath. And the comment underneath is like, that looks just like Jimmy Duresta's ice pick sheath. Were you inspired by it? And then about 5 minutes later, you sent me a message, Bob, saying, you must have got 100 messages, but Simone used your ice pick in her new product, a broken ice pick. But she ended up using the sheath, and she cut off the springy end and tapped it. And now when she picks up her basket, and she mentioned, she's like, this is the ice pick Jimmy gave me. Sorry, Jimmy, I'm using it. I'm like, and I commented underneath it. I said, I'll send you more parts. So that was cute to see that the ice pick that was in her shop, she ended up using it as the handle, which I totally encourage. And it reminds me, in fact, that Rob has really been pushing, and we're going to really do an effort. We're going to come up with a proper thing. We're going to do a promotion, a nice pick promotion, and it's going to be all about modifying your ice pick. What can you do to modify your ice pick? And you don't necessarily have to buy one from me, but you could just make your own ice pick. It's not that complicated to make the ones that I sell. So we're going to push a whole campaign of modifying the ice pick from the original design to do different things. And it has been randomly in the past, people have done stuff with it, including me. But we're going to try and do a whole campaign to see who comes up with funny ice pick uses and improvements just to promote it.
I'm constantly using my ice pick to, like, if I have to, I'll mix up epoxy with it, or I'm stirring stuff, and then I just take it over to the disc sander and I sand off the edge, and it's so over time it slowly gets smaller.
I'll send you some new ones.
But yeah, I like how it wears. It wears really nice. The brass just looks so cool.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mine lives next to my laser, and it's the thing, like, when I open it, I have to get all the little pieces out. Mm-hmm. I just, like, reach over and pull it out of the sheath. It's hanging by the sheath, and I just pull it out and, like, poke all those things and stick it back in there.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, my laser tool. Cool. David, what you got?
Well, I couldn't find anything in my video history this morning that was worth sharing, but this book that I'm reading right now, it's called Creative Metal Forming, and it's... When I was doing research on this brass hammering, because I don't really know much about it, you know, there's a few videos, but not a lot. You see, like, Instagram videos, I'm like, okay, I think I get it, but I really wanted to understand the metal forming part. And I found this book on Amazon, and there's no photos of the inside of the book. It's just, like, the cover and the back cover. And these kind of books are expensive. It's like $30-some. And like, I took a chance and I got it, and it's fantastic. It's really good. So Creative Metal Forming is my pick.
Very cool.
Maybe I'll talk to Jimmy about this in the after show. But I'm going to tell you my technique for bubbling out this brass according to what I've learned from the book, and see if you have any feedback for me.
Mm-hmm. I took a metal forming class at the Blackthorn in January, and I learned a lot about forming aluminum and brass. I could talk to you what I learned. Seems a big part of it is annealing it as you go.
Yeah, as you hammer it, it gets hard, and then you have to soften it with heat, let it cool, and then you go back to it, which is the opposite of what we did in the blacksmithing class that I took at the art museum, is you heated it up to make it soft, and while it was hot, you were hammering it.
Yeah.
Crazy. Well, mine is it's a trailer for a movie. Remember the show that I was telling you all about that I did where I went to Texas and I did like a wind episode all about tornadoes and stuff? I don't know if I told you all, they sent me the first cut of that show and it's so good. Like, they did a great job with the edit. Very, very cool. And I had to record some VO for a trailer for it a couple days ago. And during that process, they also sent me the trailer for their first feature film. So they've been working on a feature, an original, and it's out now, and it's in limited theaters. I think it'll eventually be on streaming soon, but it's called Matter of Time, and it's like a fun-looking sci-fi thing about a kid, a video game designer that gets a ring that lets him stop time, and, you know... I don't know. It's a sci-fi thing, but it's got Sean Astin in it. Sean Astin from Goonies and from Rudy. Lord of the Rings. He was Samwise. And so it's funny because it's Samwise being the kind of, the Obi-Wan character to this younger kid who wants a ring that lets him stop time. There's some like funny things there, but it looks great, and I haven't been able to see the movie yet, but I just wanted to put it out there in case anybody, you know, sees the trailer and has the opportunity to see this in a theater. They're friends of mine, they're great creative people, and I just hope it does well. It looks really fun. So it's called Matter of Time. You guys got anything else for this week? Cool. All right, wish me luck on the Gia. And thanks for listening, everybody.
Thank you.
Catch you next time.
Love you.